Democrats duke it out over who's best to battle John Cornyn. Bob Garrett of the Dallas Morning News with the takeaways from debate night. That's today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown of the Texas Standard Newsroom. More on Tuesday night's debate broadcast statewide and the one presidential candidate striking fear in the hearts of some Texas Democratic politicos. A hint, he's a Democrat. Also, using federal gun laws to help battle domestic violence, a new report on widespread flaring in West Texas. How bad is it, and will it lead to tightening regulations? All those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 19th day of February 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Got plans tonight? You know there's a debate, right? This one's kind of special in that for the first time in this series of Democratic presidential debates, there will be a place on the stage for a candidate who's truly turned Texas into a launching pad for his national campaign. You may have heard his name. Heck, my 10-year-old has heard his name. It's so ubiquitous. His ads here in the Lone Star State, Michael Bloomberg, or Mike as he'd have Texans call him. He's a former mayor of New York and another billionaire in the race for the White House, hoping to topple the incumbent, a billionaire from New York. With his ads and massive ground game here in the Lone Star State, Michael Bloomberg has rocketed to second place in the national polls, even though he sat out the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primaries. The real test, his team reckons, is how he'll do here in Texas come Super Tuesday, which is March 3rd. Early voting is already underway, as you may know, but one of the real questions Democrats in Texas are struggling with is whether and to what extent the Democratic presidential nominee affects races down ballot. Well, I can tell you the Democrats hoping to contest Republican John Cornyn for his Senate seat are taking nothing for granted. Last night, 11 of the 12 Democrats did battle in a debate broadcast statewide on many of these public radio stations. And you can bet Robert Garrett was listening closely. He covers politics as Austin Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Bob, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me back, David.
I think job one, maybe, for a lot of these folks who appeared on stage last night was just getting their name out there. I mean, you have 11 candidates, and only a couple are known beyond some political insiders, right?
That's right. They were an interesting, I called them a motley crew, not as a pejorative, but just such an interesting range of people from around Texas. Lots of work experiences, lots of pitches on why they should be the one to go up against John Cornyn. The problem for most is they're not known. And as John Cornyn's campaign manager, John Jackson, taunted last night, undecided remains the leading Democratic candidate.
MJ Hagar may be one of the best known. She is a former Air Force pilot, and she mounted a pretty serious challenge to U.S. Congressman John Carter, right?
That's right. The most recent polls show that big TV buy for her by Vote Vets, a super PAC closely aligned with the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee in Washington, which is backing her, has helped her separate from the pack.
It seems as if a lot of people were sort of piling on MJ Hagar, saying that having the support from this Democratic Congressional Committee was sort of like having outsiders put their thumb on the scales in a Texas race.
That's right. Several candidates took shots at her on that, but she sort of said that group in D.C. is all about winning and flipping this seat away from the Republicans. And she credited them, of course, with having sage judgment in finding the best candidate.
What about other standouts of the night? Did anyone else stand out to you?
Royce West, the senator from Dallas, compared himself to LBJ. He was, of course, defending himself on a question that aren't people looking for a fresh face? MJ Hagar had said, I'm a fresh face. West said, you know, LBJ had a lot of legislative experience, and then he did Medicare, Medicaid, lots of major landmark legislation. Chris Bell, the former gubernatorial candidate of Houston, sort of took on the LBJ mantle himself, noting that he, Bell, and LBJ served in the U.S. House and had each one unsuccessful statewide race before they went to the U.S. Senate. And of course, that's a big presumption for Chris Bell to put himself in the Senate yet. And then, you know, the other sort of newcomers, Christina Zinzun Ramirez, the labor activist from Austin, and Houston's former city council member Amanda Edwards, touted themselves more as the younger ones who could put together the demographic voting coalition, similar to what Beto O'Rourke had as the best chance to beat Cornyn.
I guess that's something that I keep coming back to, and that is, where are Texas Democrats right now? Do they see their biggest opportunities in the suburbs still, as they were talking about in 2018? Or are you talking about younger voters, those who are supporting Bernie Sanders, who, by the way, in the UT Texas Tribune poll, seems to be polling at number one among Texas Democrats? I mean, the progressive side of the party.
Well, that is the demographic that Zinzun Ramirez and Edwards are targeting. They are both pretty young themselves, and they are saying that we have to fire up those people and give them a reason, a clear-cut brand difference from sort of not warmed over Republican light. John Jackson, Cornyn's campaign manager, of course, dismissed all of these 11 as just Bernie Sanders clones. But if you looked at the big issues on Sanders' Medicare for All bill, only four of the 11 said they were for it. Seven were against it, including Hagar West, Edwards, and Bell. Similarly, they didn't take a show of hands on Green New Deal, but only a couple of the candidates supported that. Most did not. So they really, for the most part, are not Sanders, Elizabeth Warren clones. They're more centrist as a rule.
You should dig deeper into this, dear listener. Robert Garrett's been writing about it for the Dallas Morning News. We'll link to his latest over at texasstandard.org. Bob, good to talk with you again. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, David.
It's been fashionable in recent years for candidates to proudly describe themselves as political outsiders. Well, across big parts of rural Texas, that hasn't been going over so well of late. So reports Patrick Svitek for the Texas Tribune. Patrick, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me on.
When we talk about political outsiders, there are outsiders and then there are outsiders. We're talking about the latter group, people who, what, don't even live in the districts that they want to represent?
Well, it's not that they don't live in the districts that they're currently running for. It's that they, in some cases, have pretty questionable ties to the district. And you're seeing questions about those ties to the district come up in pretty dramatic ways in some of these races. And these are happening across congressional primaries that affect both parties, but particularly seeing it in Republican congressional primaries this cycle, and particularly even within that category in districts that are a little more rural, where there is a premium on local connections, on knowing that a person is from your community and is, you know, of your community. You know, this happens every cycle in Texas. There's, of course, no law that requires someone even live in the district, the congressional district that they're running for. But it's really playing out on a much broader scale this time than in recent election cycles in Texas.
I want to ask you why that is. But first, I want to get back to something that you were just talking about, because people who don't follow politics may be surprised to hear that you don't have to live in the district that you are running to represent. Is that right?
Right. At the congressional level in Texas, you don't have to live in the district that you're running for, and you don't even have to, you know, be from it. So it's not really a legal issue here. It's about whether this is a, I guess, a political issue for some of these candidates and a political vulnerability.
And I guess the vernacular would be carpet bagging is what
exactly
this has been described.
Exactly.
As.
Yeah. Or district shopping is also
district
the term
shopping
that gets, thrown around.
Why is it that we're seeing so many right now? And is there any rhyme or reason to the fact that it seems to be happening in Republican races?
Well, we have a high number of vacancies in the congressional map this cycle. You have six Texas Republican congressmen retiring, and three of them are retiring in safely Republican territory, meaning that those seats coming open are in some cases a once in a generation opportunity, because once you win them, you're likely to be reelected in those districts for a very long time, as long as you're, relatively competent.
Such is the power of incumbency. Yes, right.
And so that's why they've drawn such crowded fields. And within those crowded fields, you obviously have some people who sense more political opportunity than others and have been willing to move from other parts of the state or maintain just tenuous ties to the district while running for it.
Can we name some names? I mean, are there some people who seem to be at the center of some of these allegations?
Sure, there are a number of prominent examples. You have former Dallas Congressman Pete Sessions. He is actually, he lost re-election last in 2018 to and his seat flipped to a Democrat, Colin Allred. He's now running to replace retiring Representative Bill Flores in a district that is south of his old Dallas-based district. It's a Waco and College Station Bryan-based district. So Sessions, he grew up in Waco and had, you know, represented some of those counties in a previous district farther north when it was under different boundaries. Mm-hmm. But there's no doubt he's an outsider to that district in terms of having any, you know, recent ties to it before running for it. Up in the panhandle, you have the 13th congressional district where the Republican incumbent Mac Thornberry is retiring, and it's drawn a Republican field of 15 candidates. And one of the more serious candidates is a guy named Chris Ekstrom, who moved into the district into Wichita Falls after being known as someone who is a prominent Republican donor in the Dallas area. So that's about a 2-hour drive.
Yeah.
And it's interesting in that case, too, because Thornberry's district is one of the most conservative congressional districts in the country, if not the most conservative congressional district. And you follow Chris Ekstrom on the campaign trail, and he's definitely taken heat for not being from the district. But he's seeming to bet that people in that district and in that Republican primary electorate are going to care more about having a candidate who represents their deeply conservative values than necessarily someone who's been around the district the longest.
How much will the Carpetbagger brand make a difference when Texans go to the polls? We're about to find out. Patrick Svitek is covering this story for the Texas Tribune. We'll link to his latest over at texasstandard.org. Patrick, good to talk with you again. Thank you, sir.
Thanks a lot.
Time to check in with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. What do you hear out there in social media land?
Hi, David. Well, reactions coming in online to the story at the top of the show, that 11-person Democratic debate between candidates looking to take on John Cornyn in November. Here are some of the reactions we're seeing on our Facebook page. There, Janice Hitchcock writes, I think that MJ Hagar is right and that a public option for health insurance is a good first step towards universal health care. However, Brad Emmons says this about the field at large. He writes that Beto O'Rourke couldn't unseat a Republican Texas senator with less tenure, money, and power. Good luck trying to make it happen with this bunch. Meanwhile, Victoria Sada says that countywide early voting in Texas has begun through February 28th. Your vote is your voice. Be heard, Texans. And speaking of debates, tonight's presidential debate, the first including Michael Bloomberg, already has folks talking, as you might expect. I'll be back with some of those reactions later on.
Hey, let's hear from you, Texas, if you haven't reached out to us. Find that social media platform of choice and look for Texas Standard on it. Wells Dunbar is looking for you, and he'll be back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be responsible world citizens. More on how a trip to Norway challenged students' perspectives on mass incarceration and justice at tcu.edu/stories.
Hey, this is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The Trump administration has expanded its travel ban to 6 more countries, including Nigeria, the largest economy in Africa. While Nigerian students and travelers are still welcome to visit, family members trying to immigrate to the U.S. are not. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval has been looking into how one of Texas's largest Nigerian communities is reckoning with these changes.
Saheed says he can't wait to begin his new life as a married man. He shows me a video from the day he popped the question.
Yeah, she saw me. She was so surprised. She never expected it.
Saheed asked me not to use his last name because he's afraid it could hurt his wife's immigration case. He's 32, a U.S. citizen, and has lived almost half his life in this country. He met his wife, Azizit, through family back in Nigeria.
She's a neighbor of my aunt in Nigeria.
Azizit is a doctor. Saheed is a pharmacist. They got married a year ago and applied for Azizit's visa to join Saheed in the U.S. Their paperwork was in order. All they had to do was wait.
It is heartbreaking as well for her. Because, I mean, there's nothing more important for newlyweds than to be together.
Many Nigerians were in shock when the U.S. added Nigeria to the list of 13 countries facing a travel ban.
We were somewhat blindsided with the announcement of the visa restrictions by the U.S.
That's Nigerian Foreign Minister Jeffrey Onyema at a news conference with U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
President Trump announced the suspension of immigrant visas for Nigerians because Nigeria has room to grow in sharing important national security information. I'm optimistic that's going to happen.
Pompeo's comments offer some hope, says Houston area immigration attorney Busayo Fasidi. But even so, she says many Nigerians are right to worry the ban will keep them from being reunited with their family.
Most of my clients are trying to bring in their family members from overseas. Those ones that are trying to bring in their family members will be gravely impacted.
She says she's been bombarded with phone calls and messages about the ban.
A lot of people file for their elderly parents, also spouses and children.
Fasidi says she was shocked when she heard about the ban, but she doesn't see this particular policy as discriminatory. She says Nigeria should improve its security measures. Nigerian elder and Texas Southern University professor Chris Ulasi has his doubts.
I don't buy the reasoning. A country is not normally banned or place undue restrictions on the countries that they have good relationship with.
Nigeria is one of the United States' top trading partners in Africa, exporting millions of barrels of oil each month. Nearly 300,000 Nigerians live in the U.S., and Julia Gillette with the Migration Policy Institute says a lot of them are quite successful.
They have pretty high rates of educational attainment. They're more likely to have a bachelor's degree or a graduate degree than U.S.-born people.
She says the Trump administration could be justified in its reasoning for the visa ban, but there's good reason to be skeptical.
What's interesting about this version is that it doesn't block those temporary visas for tourists or business travelers or students or temporary workers. And what that suggests is that the government doesn't see an imminent travel threat from any of these countries.
Gillette says blocking permanent visas seems like a way the U.S. government can pressure other countries to change their policies because these visitors pose no immediate threat. While Nigeria and the United States negotiate, thousands of people's lives are on pause. People like Azizet, who is studying to one day validate her medical degree in the U.S., and Saheed, who is saving up for a house where he hopes they'll someday live together. I'm Elizabeth Troval for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. As oil and gas production is ramped up in the Permian Basin, so too has flaring, the burning off of natural gas, a byproduct of oil extraction that there isn't room for in existing pipelines. Well, the resulting emissions can damage the atmosphere, but it's a ubiquitous practice in the oil field, as many folks out in West Texas will tell you. Just how bad is it? Well, a new report released by Texas Railroad Commissioner Ryan Sitton aims to clear things up. Whether it actually does is a question for Mose Bouchel, energy and environment reporter for KUT Austin. Hey there, Mose.
Hey, David. How are you doing?
Doing fine. I think just to clear things up, the Texas Railroad Commission is the energy regulator here in the Lone Star State.
That's right. That's a little explanation you have to give before every story.
Every single one. Yeah, just for those who are uninitiated here. So what about this report, and does it in fact shed light on whether flaring is any worse or better than previously thought?
Oh, yeah, it's an interesting report. It's really the first report that we've seen from a railroad commissioner on this really controversial topic. And it does several things. It, number one, kind of names certain companies for how much they're flaring. So you get to kind of compare one company from another in terms of how much natural gas it's burning off into the atmosphere. And then it also takes a novel approach, I guess, at how it measures flaring. It looks at the amount of flaring a company does versus how much oil it's producing, which is
sort of an efficiency measurement, I guess.
Yeah, more of an efficiency measurement than maybe just kind of a flat impact on the environment in terms of the numbers of flaring.
We should point out something here. The concern about that gas that's extracted, that waste gas, I guess you could say, is that a lot of that's methane. And methane is a contributor to climate change.
And in fact, I think it's like 34-35% worse than carbon dioxide. But carbon dioxide is also a greenhouse gas, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so what they're doing is when this methane kind of comes off the oil well or any kind of any step in the oil production and transportation system, they'll flare the methane off. That's essentially like burning natural gas. Yeah. So it contributes to climate change. And also, it's just vastly wasteful. Everybody recognizes this. People in industry recognize this. There's one estimate that says that enough gas is flared to power every home in Texas. So, yeah. I mean, it's just a big waste of energy, even putting aside the environmental impact.
And there's no way to capture it? That seems kind of incredible, especially considering that, I mean, the reason that there's all this activity in the Permian Basin is to make some money.
Right. And, well, and Ben, this is the thing. There is this what they call a pipeline constraint. There isn't all the infrastructure to get this gas to market. That's true. That's one of the reasons. But there's also a financial reason for this. There are companies that flare gas simply because they won't make a profit off of it. It's too cheap.
The economics.
It's simple economics. Yeah. And so, you know, that's one thing that you'll see in this report is that a lot of the blame for flaring goes to this lack of pipeline infrastructure. The reality is much more complicated. A lot of it really is just a financial consideration. The companies are trying to think about their bottom line, and flaring really makes sense for them to save as much money as they can.
Very interesting. Okay, so you bounced these findings off a few experts in the field, and what was the feedback?
Well, you know, industry was very supportive when they read this report yesterday. They thought it was a novel approach, a good way to look at this as like you said, an efficiency measure. Environmental groups a little bit more skeptical. They kind of view this as, well, one guy told me it was moving the goalposts, right? That in fact the Railroad Commission has the authority right now to regulate this flaring more strictly. It has chosen not to do that, and so while it has that authority, it should use it rather than maybe kind of play with the numbers and take different approaches to look at it.
I guess the question that a lot of listeners may have is this going to lead to tighter regulation on the industry?
The report does not answer that question. And so, you know, the debate will remain. It's just that this report does offer a kind of fresh look and some new, so it's presenting some numbers that don't often get presented out in public like this, even though it's all publicly available data.
Mose Bushell is energy and environment reporter for KUT right here in the Texas capital city. Thanks for breaking this down for us, Mose.
Thank you, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Tarrazas. A federal judge says the government is not responsible for damage Houston area residents sustained when floodwaters were released from two U.S. Army Corps dams following Hurricane Harvey. Gabrielle Banks with the Houston Chronicle explains where the judge laid blame for the need to release water from the Attix and Barker dams in an opinion issued Tuesday.
The judge said that those gates had been closed to protect them against catastrophic flooding, and that they were opening control releases. The fact that they flooded was Harvey's fault. It was the weather. It was not the government's fault.
Another judge from the same court ruled in a separate case last fall that the Army Corps of Engineers was liable for damage caused to other property owners who lived near the dams. A new Small Business Administration Disaster Recovery Office is now open in Houston to help those affected by last month's deadly explosion at a Watson grinding and manufacturing facility. As Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner reports, the January 24th blast damaged hundreds of homes and businesses.
The Small Business Administration is offering low-interest federal disaster loans to affected businesses. Certain nonprofit organizations, homeowners, and renters may also apply. The loans will be available to people in Brazoria, Chambers, Fort Bend, and Galveston, as well as Harris, Liberty, Montgomery, and Waller counties. Applicants can apply online or in person at the Harris County Disaster Loan Outreach Center. For more information, visit readyharris.org. I'm Sasha Cordner in Houston.
Early voting is underway in Texas for the March 3rd primaries, and the Texas Election Protection Coalition is running a hotline to assist voters who encounter problems at the polls. Emily Eby with the Texas Civil Rights Project is one of the lawyers fielding calls for the hotline. She describes a few rights voters might not realize they have when casting a ballot.
One of the most important things I think that voters don't know is that if you have a disability or if you speak a different language, you are welcome and allowed by Texas law to bring an assistant into the voting booth with you.
The hotline is 866-OUR-VOTE. An energy company operating in the Texas Panhandle plans to refund customers nearly $40 million. Xcel Energy spokesperson Wes Reeves says they can provide the reimbursement because of lower fuel costs and the increase in wind energy.
Wind energy is making electricity cheaper, and it's now actually cheaper than generating with coal power in our region.
The refund will be about $36 per customer. I'm Lauren Terrazas for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Old Settlers Music Festival, April 16th to 19th, just outside Austin, with The Head and the Heart, Tanya Tucker, Sam Bush, Jade Bird, and more. Full lineup at oldsettlersmusicfest.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. For years, Texas Democrats have been trying to flip the state house ever since Republicans flipped it to red a couple of decades back. But one thing some Dems say could foil those plans is if one Bernie Sanders, seen by some here as too liberal, should win the Democratic nomination for president. Here to talk with us about that is Renuka Ryasam. She is an Austin-based reporter for Politico. Welcome to the Standard, Renu.
Thanks for having me.
This is a very provocative story that ran in Politico over the weekend. What is it that you're hearing from Democratic operatives here in the Lone Star State about that presidential race?
So veterans who've been here for a long time have been trying to flip the state house and congressional districts, blue, let alone purple, for years. They're saying, hey, this is finally our chance. We've got Donald Trump on the Republican side, this unpopular president. We've got the state that's growing and changing really fast. We have this opening. And if you have a candidate like Bernie Sanders at the top of the ticket as sort of the figurehead for the Democratic Party, you know, this is someone who calls himself a socialist very openly, that could really make it tough for down-ballot candidates that are in some of these tight races trying to convince voters to vote for them instead of a Republican incumbent.
Is the thinking that Texas isn't ready for a candidate like Bernie Sanders on the Democratic ticket, and that will mean people won't turn out to vote down-ballot? Is that the theory?
There's a couple of different theories here, but the one that I've been hearing among sort of longtime Democratic veteran operatives in the state is that this is a red state. It's a conservative state. It's not a battleground state. It's not a swing state. And they're trying to win in districts where Republicans have long held seats. Mm-hmm. And their theory is that the way to get people to vote for a Democrat in this cycle is to sort of convince them, you know, we're sort of the best steward of the state house in the next election cycle. And they're seeing somebody like Bernie Sanders, who is a Democratic socialist, but one who's talked about, let's say, nationalizing the energy industry and nationalizing the healthcare industry. And they're saying once people start to pick apart his ideas, that'll really spook a lot of these moderate voters that they could maybe convince over to their side in this cycle.
Part of this theory is built around the idea that it's the suburbs that are up for grabs.
Absolutely.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you look at some of the polls that have been coming out. Yeah. The latest University of Texas, Texas Tribune poll puts Bernie Sanders in the front seat when it comes to preferences among Democrats. Is it possible that the political operatives have got it wrong?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's a guessing game, right? I mean, and what progressives and what a lot of, I would say, newcomers to Texas politics are saying is, hey, you've had your shot for 20 years to flip this state purple or blue, and you haven't done it. They're saying, we actually do need somebody like Bernie Sanders at the top of the ticket. And that's, I think, people who are sort of entering Texas politics in the last couple of election cycles. And so they see things a little bit differently, for sure. And it's absolutely true that veterans could have this wrong, but they're looking at, I think, they're sort of looking not necessarily broadly across the state. And they're not saying, and I don't think very many people are saying, that a Democrat's going to win Texas on the presidential race. They're looking at these districts and looking at those voters and kind of trying to say, okay, what is it going to take to get those voters to come out and vote for a Democrat for a state rep?
It's important to note that the stakes are higher than just flipping some seats.
Absolutely.
We have congressional reapportionment coming up very soon, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this fight takes on sort of a different tone this year because like I said, there's a big opportunity, but there's also a lot at stake, and that's redistricting. So if the State House and the State Senate next year are going to be able to redraw congressional districts, Democrats stand to gain a handful of congressional seats, depending on how the maps are drawn. And so Democrats want a seat at that table. And if they control the State House, they have a lot more control over how those districts get drawn and who's going to be the voter base for the next 10 years.
One indication of just how much a liability a Sanders candidacy might be what Republican operatives have to say about this. What are you hearing from them?
Well, the GOP is saying they're all socialists. So,
of course they are, right?
Yeah. So they are saying, hey, it doesn't matter if we've got Biden or Bloomberg, you know, who used to be a Republican mayor of New York, Warren or Klobuchar, they're all socialists. They all talk about raising your taxes. And
but who are they most afraid of?
I think for them, it would be, they have yet to show fear. They're like, they feel very confident. Most of the GOP operatives I've talked to, they feel like all the folks at the top of the ticket are going to be too left for Texas. And they're going to talk endlessly about job creation, about taxes, and those are things that people care about.
It's a provocative story, and one definitely worth checking out if you haven't already. Renuka Ryasam is an Austin-based reporter for Politico, and we'll link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Renu, thanks so much for stopping by and speaking with us. Good to meet you.
Great to be here.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, celebrating spring break with golf beaches, seafood, and family-friendly attractions, including Moody Gardens, dolphin-watching adventures, and more. Details at Galveston.com.
Did you ever sit straight up in bed with something circling around your head, and you swat at it as it whizzes by, and it's just one pesky little fly? You shake your head and twitch your nose and settle down to sweet repose. And when you're just about to doze, fly trouble.
My name is Wizzy Brown, and I'm with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service, and I work with insects. Springtails are typically found outdoors. These are small wingless insects. They come in different body shapes and different colors, but they are going to have a little tail that's called a furcula, and then they have this little kind of latch thing on their body that they will hook the tail into, and then when they release it, it causes them to spring through the air, which is why they get the name springtails. So these are going to be found in moist organic matter. They're going to feed on decaying organic stuff. Usually they're outside. They can move indoors. So if you have potted plants, especially if you bring potted plants inside from outside, you can bring them in with you. They can also be in areas of moisture inside. I have seen them in bathroom areas that aren't really ventilated properly. I have also seen them in areas where people have a pipe that is leaking in a wall void area. And so these are one of those kind of indicator insects that we use, because if you have them inside your house, that really signifies that there is a moisture problem somewhere and that you need to look for that moisture source and actually take care of it. These do not bite. They do not sting. They are simply a kind of a nuisance insect. But we really need to focus on environmental modifications to keep them out of areas that we don't want them. So one of those is going to be, how are your sprinklers hitting? Are they going away from the house to hit those landscape beds, or is it spraying onto the house itself? Because if it's doing that, that can lead to these insects being really close to the house. It can also lead to possible moisture in your wall void and causing those insects to move indoors. to figure out if you have springtails, because they can be difficult to see. Usually people mistake them for fleas because they're jumping, but they're not that typical dark brown like fleas are. We usually recommend that people put out sticky traps around the house, and you would want to label those sticky traps with where you put them out. That way it's easier to track down that source if we do find something. But you'll stick those sticky traps out and leave them for about a week, and then that will passively capture whatever you have in the area. And so then you can look at those with a hand lens or a microscope or something and see if you have those springtails, which you would definitely be able to see under magnification. So not really a problem, but definitely a cool little insect.
I'm Wizzy Brown for the Texas Standard.
Wizzy Brown is a program specialist with the Texas A&M AgriLife Service and our go-to insect expert. Something bugging you? Send us a line on social media or email texasstandard@kut.org. Sounds pretty straightforward, I suppose. Convicted domestic abusers who illegally possess guns get sent to jail with a little extra help from federal firearms laws. As Hadi Mawagdi reports for Public Media's Guns in America project, the approach could have multiple effects.
Inside the Earl Campbell Federal Building in downtown Dallas sits the U.S. Attorney for Northern Texas. Her name's Erin Neely Cox.
I'll give you just three cases. We have a lot of them, but they represent, you know, a misdemeanor, a felony, and a protective order.
We're talking about some of the cases her office has pursued in an effort to decrease violent crime. Neely Cox lands on one. The abuser was charged with having a gun after a court told him he wasn't allowed to have one.
He was served with a protective order in 2018 after allegedly holding his girlfriend and her 7-year-old daughter in his garage against their will.
Legally speaking, that protective order should have kept the abuser away from his girlfriend, but it didn't. Instead, he threatened her with a handgun.
So we prosecuted that case. He pleaded guilty, and he's currently sentenced to 30 months.
Cases like this are common. Researchers say those sorts of restrictions don't reduce the chances of domestic violence victims from being shot to death when they're given out at the state and local level.
But the federal misdemeanor crime of domestic violence firearm restriction has been associated with reductions in intimate partner homicide.
That's April Zioli. She's a professor of criminal justice at Michigan State University. Zioli studies if policies or laws can prevent gun violence.
A domestic violence event that involves a gun is far more likely to end in death than a domestic violence event that involves any other weapon.
It's this sort of research that led Neely Cox and the Department of Justice to focus on domestic violence cases as a way to cut down on violent crime overall.
With limited resources, how do we make the biggest impact with our gun crime laws? And time again, it came down to the nexus between gun crime, violent crime, and domestic violence.
This strategy makes advocates for domestic violence victims ecstatic. Jan Langbein's the CEO and founder of Genesis Women's Shelter in Dallas. And she says to end gun violence, it'll take a village.
We can shelter, but that's not good enough if there's no arrest. And the arrest isn't good enough if there aren't prosecutors prosecuting or judges hearing these cases.
Prosecuting abusers doesn't just protect women, says Langbein. It protects entire communities.
In fact, more police officers are killed responding to that crime than any other crime. So it's not just, hey, let's make her safer. Let's make our city safer. Let's make our police safer.
Advocates aren't the only ones that are happy about Neely Cox and the DOJ's crackdown on domestic abusers with guns. Arlington, Texas Police Chief Will Johnson says it takes both state and federal resources to make cities safer.
This violence is real, and being able to address it systematically has to be a priority for communities as they start to try to prevent these acts of violence from occurring.
Johnson says there's a connection between domestic violence and other violent gun crimes, like homicides and even mass shootings. Researcher April Zioli agrees.
Those who commit severe domestic violence are highly likely to commit other violent crimes as well, that they don't limit their violence to the home.
Recently, Zioli took a look at the backgrounds and criminal histories of 73 mass shooters. She was looking for a connection between mass shootings and intimate partner violence. 28 of them were known abusers. And of those 28, she says we missed out on opportunities to stop 17 of them before they acted out violently. Erin Neely Cox says law enforcement should be using all of its tools to prevent violence.
It is a community-wide issue, and men and women and all of us, we need to step up and we need to figure out a way to do something about it.
For Guns in America, I'm Hadi Mawagdi.
Guns in America and our partners at KERA are spending 2 years reporting on the role of guns in American life. You can learn more at gunsandamerica.org.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Former San Antonio Mayor Henry Cisneros says that the Alamo City has, quote, the lowest per capita income of any major Texas city. Is that a fact? Here to look into it is Madeline Meckelberg with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, good to see you back. Welcome again.
Thanks for having me.
So I suppose I should ask the what, where's, and why's and all that. Where did Cisneros make this claim to begin with?
So you're right. This is former Mayor Henry Cisneros, who's also the former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. And he was in San Antonio again this past month, I guess. And he was speaking at a city council meeting there about a new proposal for transportation investment in the city that prioritizes funding for roads over public transit.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about what's going on in San Antonio, why this is the right way forward. And he made an interesting claim. This was published in the San Antonio Express News.
Right.
And he said, quote, we are a poor city. We have the lowest per capita income of any major Texas city. Hmm. And now here we are.
So what exactly is meant by major Texas cities?
I'm glad you picked up on that. That was also my first question when I saw this claim. Obviously, there's not really a universal definition here. I went to weird parts of the internet, which are forums of people arguing over what makes a major Texas city or a major city in general, what kind of airports, how many skyscrapers.
Uh-huh.
But we decided to look at this the most simple way we could, which was to say, any Texas city with a population of at least 500,000 people by the latest census count. And that gives us a list of six Texas cities that I think people would generally agree are major cities in the state. You have Houston with 2.3 million people, San Antonio, 1.5 million, Dallas, 1.3 million, Austin with about 964,000, Fort Worth with 895,000, and El Paso with 840,000.
Sounds like you're just looking at the number of people within the city limits proper.
That's right.
Not the metropolitan
area.
Not
the metropolitan area.
Okay. So let's see. There we have our major Texas cities, our six major, according to this definition. What about the lowest per capita income? How did you begin to crack that one?
So when you're looking at per capita income, that is essentially the mean income for every person in an area. So in this case, we're talking about a city, as you said. So you take the aggregate income of a city's population and then divide it by that figure, which includes adults and it includes children as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we could get into a discussion about whether this is the best way to measure how a city is poor or not.
Right.
But he wasn't speaking about that. He said this has San Antonio has the lowest per capita income.
That
so that's what we're
kiddos,
trying to measure.
Right?
That's right.
Right.
And so to kind of give us some context here, in 2018, the per capita income in Texas was $30,641
mm-hmm.
compared to the United States, where it was $33,831.
Okay.
And then we found those figures for these six cities that we looked at, and I'm going to list them out for you in order from highest to lowest per capita income
highest
in 2018.
To lowest. All right.
So coming in first was Austin at $42,923,
mm-hmm.
then Houston, $31,162,
wow.
Fort Worth, $29,000, Dallas, $27,000, San Antonio, $24,000, and El Paso, $22,000.
All right. So I don't, did I hear San Antonio in that final list there?
You did. San Antonio was the second lowest, followed by El Paso. And I actually pulled the per capita income data from going back to 2010. Mm-hmm. And San Antonio is always this low on the list, followed by El Paso. And I even pulled in other Texas cities to get a better idea. I looked at the 10 most populous cities, and San Antonio is consistently on the lower end in terms of per capita income.
But wait. But lower end isn't the same thing as the lowest.
That's right.
Am I onto something here?
You're onto something here in that we can't really speak to major Texas city. We had to take that into consideration when we issued a ruling on this claim. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, it's on the lower end. We found in the measurement that we used for major Texas cities that El Paso had a lower per capita income, but mm-hmm. Cisneros didn't get back to me when I was trying to figure out what he was using for his comparison. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's a little unfair to hold that El Paso against him. We looked at the fact that it was consistently lowest in this measurement, and so we rated this claim mostly true.
Mostly true, PolitiFact's ruling on Henry Cisneros' claim that San Antonio has the lowest per capita income of any major Texas city. Madeline Meckleberg is with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And what do we say at the end of this thing?
And you're listening to the Texas Standard.
She does that well, don't you think?
Yeah.
Madeline Meckleberg over at PolitiFact Texas. Well, joining us here in the studio once again, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. And what are Texans talking about on this Wednesday?
Well, believe it or not, politics watchers on
social
media
are
waiting for tonight's Democratic debate, the first one to feature Michael Bloomberg. We asked our friends and listeners if they're watching and what they'll be watching for. We got a range of responses. Meredith Chafin on our Facebook page says that she is looking forward to seeing Elizabeth Warren lay out some solid policies and sharp criticism for a billionaire trying to buy his way into the DNC, a reference to a one Michael Bloomberg there. However, Kay Garth writes that I'm looking forward to actually hearing from Bloomberg and seeing if anyone spends their time attacking him or laying out their stances and vision. Definitely a lightning rod of sorts there, his first appearance here. Manuela Ornelas Armendariz, she says, I'm hoping that Amy Klobuchar shines again. And Kathleen Stout says, sadly, I expect to see further divisions until a month from now when tentative unity will emerge around the compromise candidate that does the best in the upcoming primaries.
You know what's kind of fascinating? Mm-hmm. I haven't heard the name Elizabeth Warren mentioned very much in the past several days. Joe Biden, the guy that was considered the front runner.
That guy.
Oh, yeah. Former vice president. That guy.
May have heard of him.
Mm-hmm. Hasn't... I heard that he was counting on South Carolina as being the big backstop. This is tonight's debate is in anticipation of the Nevada caucuses, right?
Yeah, and then I believe, is it on to Super Tuesday after that?
I think after those, it's on to Super Tuesday.
And then, so it'll be fascinating to see how things
shake out
there.
Absolutely.
Well, similarly, speaking of presidential politics, and Bernie Sanders, another presidential contender there, a listener tweets us about another story we aired on the show, that one on the potential effect of a Bernie Sanders candidacy on down ballot races here in Texas. Melanie Robinson tweets us that giving voice to the narrative that Bernie is too liberal for moderate voters or to flip Texas is irresponsible on behalf of media outlets, giving the theory a foothold and a platform. I guess responding there that this reporting on this could create a self-fulfilling prophecy of sorts. So interesting debate there. Interesting polling, too, about Sanders and his Democratic Socialist bona fides. I don't know if you had a chance to see that recently. I believe it was an NPR NewsHour Marist poll.
Okay.
They found out that the term socialist polls poorly, but when you just ask about Bernie Sanders himself, the politician, he polls much higher than that term. Still bests Trump in a head-to-head matchup. So interesting.
Is that that's nationwide, right?
Yes, sir.
Wow. Well, we'd love to hear what you think about this or anything else that's on your news radar, Texas. You know what to do. Just look for Texas Standard on that social media platform you like to hang out at. We know you do. Hey, listen, we're out of time for the big broadcast, but we're going to be back here tomorrow, and we hope you will join us. Till then, I'm Dave Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the crew, wishing you a wonderful Wednesday.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.